Okay, we're starting here from the last line on Pei Bet Amud Bet. Amarav, leta le matnitan mikame breita. Our Mishnah is no longer relevant because we have a breita that appends the Mishnah. Titanya, we have a breita. Rabbi Yossi Omer, androgynous, birya bifne atzmahu. An androgynous is its own entity. Velo hichriyo bo chachamim im zachar nekeva. The Chachamim never concluded as to whether it is a zakar or nekeva, whether it's a male or a female. Now the term birya bifne atzma appears in the Mishnayot in a number of locations, as well as in the Tosefta. And normally the meaning of birya bifne atzma, as Tosafot notes over here, is that it's its own entity. It's a totally new creation. It's not under the categories that we've been discussing until now. It's a new category. On the other hand, Tosafot says here, you can see the first line in the Tosafot, Omri, this is not like the birya bifne atzma that we find in other places in Jas. Sheno safek, ela birya de kamar hocha, hainu shu safek. That's what it says here, that the birya bifne atzma means that it's a safek, that it's a doubt here, whether it's a question as to whether it's a zachar nekeva, and that really feeds into the next line, which was, lo ichriu bo chachamim im zachar nekeva. The chachamim never determined whether he was a zachar nekeva. So Tosafot, there's a long Tosafot, you can see, basically proves that what he thinks is that the birya bifne atzma here is different than its manifestation in the rest of Shas, where it means its own entity. And over here, it simply means a zachar nekeva, that it's a safek zachar, a safek nekeva, and that status is never cleared up, and therefore it remains a safek zachar nekeva in a permanent state. That's the way that Tosafot explains here, birya bifne atzma. The Ramban takes the approach that this is no different than anywhere else in Shas, and the birya bifne atzma over here means its own entity. It's not a zachar nekeva, it's androgynous, complete new entity, something that we can't put into the whole of zachar, we can't fit into the whole of nekeva. It is a third definition of what you can be. You can be a zachar, you can be a nekeva, and you can be an androgynous. One of those three categories. I mean, it's an additional category of classification that someone can fall under. Now, between those, you can have different scenarios, and the Rishonim all have different views on this. And this is true anytime you have a safek. It's true by Ben Hashmashot. When we say Ben Hashmashot, the safek yom, safek laila. In any of these instances, you can look at safek yom, safek laila. Here's safek zachar, safek nekeva. How do you view that? Now, you can view it as being simply somewhat like the Tosafot over here, which is that it's safek zachar, safek nekeva, which means that it's either a zachar or nekeva. We're just not sure which one it is. So you have possibility that it's a zachar, possibility that it's a nekeva. We can't come to a hachra'ah. That's the way Tosafot says. We can't come to a conclusion about it. And therefore, we're going to have to treat it like a full zachar, like a full nekeva. But that means that anything that applies to a zachar will be applicable here, l'chumra. Everything that applies to a nekeva will also be applicable here, l'chumra. So that's one way to look at that safek. The way the Ramban views it as a birya bifne atzma, then the categories in zachar and nekeva are no longer relevant to the androgynous, and therefore in any halacha where you have a din of zachar, a din of nekeva, androgynous should automatically be dropped out, unless there's a specific riboy to bring androgynous back in to the category. That's part of what Tosafot discusses over here, that we find other places where he's included under certain terms, and it doesn't sound like he's a birya bifne atzma. But the Ramban says he is, and therefore you're going to need a specific riboy anytime you want to include him under a category that includes zachar and nekeva. Now, in between that, you can have the possibility that he is partially zachar, partially nekeva, which not like Tosafot, who says that he's either 100% zachar, 100% nekeva, but he can be 50% zachar, 50% nekeva. I mean that it is a birya bifne atzma in some sense, but he has character traits or likeness to a zachar, likeness to a nekeva, and he has parts like a zachar, parts like a nekeva, and in certain instances we're going to treat him like a zachar, certain instances we're going to treat him like a nekeva. He's not a zachar, 100%, he's not a 100% nekeva, but he has properties that where he is called a zachar, properties where he is called a nekeva. That's another possibility of viewing the safek. Tosafot says that mitzad safek, you could argue that the zachar nekeva, is that right? That he's 100% zachar, 100% nekeva. That's not a safek, he is both of those together at 100%. And therefore, again, the chumrah, you're going to have to deal with him in all these instances. Just, you should know that there's a lot of polemic and permutations about this androgynos about how to explain this birya bifnei atzma, especially since Tosafot again over here says that this isn't your standard birya bifnei atzma, so it brings you into that question, the same question that you have with ben hashmashot, when we say it's a fake yom, it's a fake laila, do we say that there is an exact point where it switches over, we just don't know? So Safek Yom and Safek Laila is that either it is Yom or it's Laila, we just don't know where that threshold is. Do we say that Ben HaShemashot, Safek Yom, Safek Laila is a new creation, which is Ben HaShemashot, it's not Yom and it's not the Laila? Or maybe there's a creation called Safek Yom, Safek Laila, which is it's both Yom and Laila, it has characteristics of both. So again, you can have the same Safek comes up in these types of areas where you're at a threshold and you just have properties of both. How do you explain that? So Androgynos says that you have the same thing, Ben HaShemashot, any type of Safek, we have that, the same thing comes up with a koi, with a animal that lo yichriyo bo, chachamim, im behema, im chaya, whether it's a behema or a chaya, also there you have these different opinions, Safek chaya, Safek behema, via bifnei atzma, you have all of these different permutations that come up by a koi. Alright, so that's number one. The second thing Rav says is that the Braita overrides the Mishnah, which of course the Gemara is going to challenge at this point in time, that why does a Braita override a Mishnah? But there is an assumption here, and this is an important assumption in the Mishnah, which is, the Mishnah says, Sris Chama Kohen, Shnasa Bat Yisrael Machila B'Tshuma. Then you have Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon Omrim. So here is the introduction of Rabbi Yossi's opinion in the Mishnah, which is, Androgynous Kohen, Shnasa Bat Yisrael Machila B'Tshuma. That's their statement. Then you have Rabbi Huda Omer, Tom Tom Shinikrab Nimsa Zachar Lo Yachlots Mdei Shu Kesaris. We'll get to that later in today's daf. And then we have another statement, which is Androgynous Nosei Aval Lo Nisa. Androgynous can marry, but cannot be married too. Cannot be the object of the marriage. He can be the active partner in the marriage. He can grant Kiddushin, he can't receive Kiddushin. Saying that he's a Zachar, not a Nekeva. The question is the attribution of that statement. Androgynous Nosev Aval Nisa. Afterwards, you have Rabbi Eliezer, who comes into the Mishnah. Then the Mishnah continues, Rabbi Eliezer Omer. So we know the last statement is Rabbi Eliezer's statement. We know there's a statement Rabbi Yehuda in the middle. The question is the attribution of the statement, Androgynous Nose Avalonisa. The Bavli assumes that that statement is associated with Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon. And it's a continuation of their statement. And Rabbi Yehuda was a parenthetical statement in the middle of their speaking in the Mishnah. So Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon said, Androgynous Kohen Shenasa Bat Yisrael Machila B'Tshuma. Then the next line of theirs would be Androgynous Nose Avalonisa. Rabbi Yehuda's statement in the middle is just parenthetical. That creates all the problems. Again, if you didn't say that, we'd skip after daf today, because it wouldn't be an issue at all. That's what the Yerushalmi does. The Yerushalmi just says that latter piece is associated with Rabbi Yehuda, and not with Rabbi Yossi, and then you don't have as much of a problem, because then you have a very different looking Mishnah than what we're discussing over here. The problem arises because the Bavli gives attribution to that statement to Rabbi Yossi, and because of that, you have this issue where you're facing off against the Braita, where Rabbi Yossi Omer Androgynous Birya Bifnei Atzma, Uvelo Yichriyo Bo Chachamim Zechar Nekeva. So Gemara says, Ad Rabo, let the Braita mikame matnitan, drop the Braita from in front of the Mishnah. The Mishnah should govern. It is more authentic, more veracity associated with the Mishnah than there is with the Braita. You would say, keep the Mishnah throughout the Braita. Gemara says, Mi Deshavki Rabbi Yossi the Bar Zugei, because Rabbi Yossi dropped his partner, Shma Mino Hodor Bey. From that, you can conclude that he reversed his position. And that's not so simple, but what the proof of the Gemara is that in the Braita, Rabbi Yossi appears alone. It's Titania, Rabbi Yossi Omer. In our Mishnah, he appears together with Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon. The Gemara's conclusion is, therefore, Rabbi Yossi dropped Rabbi Shimon to go off on his own, to do his own thing, and therefore, that's the opinion that's governing. Now, you could have just as easily said the opposite, which is, Rabbi Yossi originally had his own opinion, and then in the Mishnah, he realized he was wrong, and now he joins the Rabbi Shimon. So why is this the proof? The Tosfot Yishanim over here suggests that it's because, in Zekushia, that's not a question why you wouldn't do it the other way around. Das Vorohu. He says it's a logical argument. Dematnitan kadma lebraita. The Mishnah came before the Braita. The Mishnah was, chronologically, the Mishnah was codified before the Braita or Tosefta that we're quoting over here, before the Tosefta, because Rabbi was the one who put the Mishnah together, whereas the Tosefta is put together according to the Gemara by Rabbi Chia, who is a Talmud of Rabbi's. So just chronologically, the Tosefta is after the Mishnah. So if Rabbi Yossi was still maintaining his position with Rabbi Shimon, you should have seen Rabbi Shimon mentioned in the Tosefta. The fact that you don't shows you that he changed his mind. So that's the way that the Tosfot Yeshanim says that its proof is just, forget about the question as to, like, he left his partner, didn't leave his partner, that could work either direction. The point is that it's chronologically, the Mishnah comes first, then the Braita, and therefore, we're gonna give the Braita more weight in determining what Rabbi Yossi's final position is. So according to the way that Rav is suggesting over here, Rabbi Yossi left Rabbi Shimon and now has a different opinion with regards to androgynous. On the other hand, Ushmol Amar, let the Braita become a matanitin. Shmuel says just the opposite, that we drop the Braita in the face of the Mishnah. Gemara says, Adarabba, let the matanitin become a Braita. Let us drop the Mishnah in the face of the Braita. Dashminin le Shmuel, the Chayish l'chiyudo. So even Shmuel in himself says that we're choshesh for shitot of a yachid, meaning that if it is a shita that has some sort of weight, even though it's not the way that we paskin, we'll be choshesh for that shita, and we'll worry about it. So here, if Rabbi Yossi has such a shita, we should be choshesh for that shita of Rabbi Yossi anytime we look at any halachic ramification from this. So how would you say that the Mishnah governs and just drop that statement about Rabbi Yossi in the Braita, in the Tosefta? Gemara says, Hani mi lekilo mitakra matanitin. When does Shmuel say that we worry about a dat yachid impacting the way that we view a position? That's only when it doesn't undermine a Mishnah. But about kimiatra matanitin, when it undermines a Mishnah, lo chayish, he doesn't worry about it. So yes, Shmuel has that principle, which we invoked earlier in the Masechta, but we don't use it here. It doesn't govern over here because by doing that, you'd have to undermine our Mishnah. And we're not going to undermine our Mishnah in order to be choshesh for this dat yachid of Rabbi Yossi. So therefore, Shmuel says the Mishnah governs over here, whereas Rav says that the Braita, the Tosefta, governs over here. Which means, obviously, when you have a machloket, Rabbi Yossi's position carries a lot of weight. Because when it comes to Rabbi Yossi v'Rabbi Yehuda, halacha k'Rabbi Yossi. When it comes to a machloket, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Meir, halacha k'Rabbi Yehuda. That means, from transitive property, that Rabbi Yossi trumps both Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Yossi's position usually carries a lot of weight because of that, because of the nature of psak. So if you say that Rabbi Yossi of the Mishnah is the real opinion of Rabbi Yossi, that would mean that the halacha is that he's kizachar. That's what it sounds like from our Mishnah. On the other hand, if you have the Tosefta being the governing view of Rabbi Yossi, then Rabbi Yossi is a birya bifnei atzma, and then you have to deal with that situation, again, depending on how you view the Rishonim. But that would more likely than not be the halacha. So now, Amrei Bei Rav, Mishmei de Rav. So the Beit Midrash of Rav says in the name of Rav, here there's a big tumult about who Bei Rav is. Rashi says that Bei Rav is Rav Huna, because Rav Huna was a Talmud Muvak of Rav, and therefore Bei Rav, when we quote it, is Rav Huna. Now, even though we have a Gemara in Sanhedrin that says that it references to Rav Hamnuna, and since we have a Gemara in Sanhedrin that says whenever it says Bei Rav, it references to Rav Hamnuna, how could you argue over here that it is Rav Huna? So the way that Rashi deals with that problem is to say that in cases where there's no attribution to any Talmud, Bei Rav means Rav Huna. On the other hand, if it's Rav Huna speaking in the statement, and then it says Bei Rav, that's referring to Rav Hamnuna, because he's not, obviously, he can't be Rav Huna, because Rav Huna is the one that is speaking in that case. But Tosfot and others have a disagreement about this view of what Bei Rav is. See on that Amud Bet that they have different views as to who exactly this Bei Rav is. All right, we'll assume now that Amri Bei Rav, Mishmei de Rav, here means Allah is Rav Huna in the name of Rav. Halocha ki Rabbi Yossi be'androgynous u'behar kava. The halocha is like Rabbi Yossi, both by androgynous and by harkava. Ushmol amar, bikoshi ubikidush. So here you have four halachot. Rav says by two halachot, the halach is like Rabbi Yossi, and Shmuel brings by the two halachot that the halach is like Rabbi Yossi. So that's a question what David is asking is going to be brought up now in the Gemara, which is Shmuel additive, or is he arguing on Rav? Is he adding on two more categories, but he agrees with Rav's position, or is he simply arguing on Rav? And the absence of those two, of Shmuel by Rav, does that mean Rav disagrees with those, or he just didn't mention those? Right, that'll be the Gemara we'll come to and try to explain. That's number one. Number two is, and this is the more complex part of it, is what does that mean, that halacha k'Rabbi Yossi? Next question, we'll see, the Gemara says androgynous, hadamran. Androgynous is that which we said. What did we say about androgynous? We have two times that Rabbi Yossi is mentioned by Androgynous. We have Rabbi Yossi of our Mishnah, and we have Rabbi Yossi of the Tosefta. When he says Halacha Rabbi Yossi be Androgynous, which one does he mean? Does he mean the Mishnah, or does he mean the Tosefta? The simplest reading of the Gemara is that we just mentioned in Rav's position with regards to the Tosefta undermining the Mishnah, and the Tosefta governs. And here you have another quote from Rav. You would assume when he says Halacha ke Rabbi Yossi, that means like Rabbi Yossi of the Tosefta. That would be the simplest reading of the Gemara. When we say Halacha ke Rabbi Yossi, again, the simplest reading is to say that it continues what we said before. It's consistent with what we saw from Rav, that the Tosefta governs over here. And that's the way the Rabbeinu Hanano, the Rif, people learn this Gemara. On the other hand, Rashi and Tosafot over here say that's not the case. Rashi says that Tosafot backs him up, which is, we're going to quote three other instances where the Halacha is like Rabbi Yossi. And as Rashi points out, in every one of those cases, it's Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon. Every other case that we bring down, the quotes are Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon presenting Halacha, and we say Halacha Rabbi Yossi. And therefore Rashi says, it's got to be over here that Halacha Rabbi Yossi means Halacha Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon, meaning our Mishnah. And therefore, what is stated here is Halacha ke Rabbi Yossi of the Mishnah. And therefore, as Rashi points out, they're arguing on the previous statement, Amar Rav, that we had before that was quoted. It's a machloket amuraim as to what Rav's position is. Before we said Rav said that the Tosefta governs. And this position, the Bei Rav, or Rav Huna, is clearly saying that the Mishnah governs, not the Tosefta. And therefore, Halacha ke Rabbi Yossi means like Rabbi Yossi of our Mishnah. So that's the machloket, the Ramban. Who, in general, this is the nature of the Ramban. The Ramban is a later Rishon. He's able to see all the Rishonim and all the opinions before him. So he's amazing in that way because usually someone of that level or that lateness in terms of the Rishonim basically becomes a collector of all the different opinions and just is Machria. What's so powerful about the Ramban is that he does that. Plus, he's a huge Chachan. He's an amazing Mechadesh in his Perush. And that's what makes the Perush Ramban and the Chushay Ramban carry so much weight. Is that, first of all, he's a later Rishon, so he's seeing a lot of all the opinions before him. But then, not only does he do that, he'll come up with his own opinion, even in the face of collecting the other opinions and just saying, oh, maybe the Halacha is this way or this way. He'll come in and insert his own way to viewing this. And over here, he does a similar thing. He leans towards Rabbeinu Kanal on the Rif, the simple reading that the Halacha Rabbi Yossi is like the Tosefta, but his point is, or one of the proofs that he has, is that the Gemara here says Halacha ke Rabbi Yossi. Why does it say Halacha Rabbi Yossi if all the cases mention Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon? It should have said Halacha Rabbi Yossi with Rabbi Shimon. The fact that it says Halacha Rabbi Yossi already shows you that it's the case where it's just Rabbi Yossi and not Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon. So he does it for a different reason, not because it's a continuation before, but because of the way that the Gemara expressed it. He says, you're right, they're all about Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon. But the fact that it said Halacha Rabbi Yossi already indicates there must be something different in one of these cases where it's not all Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon. All right, so that's the controversy around Androgynous, Adam Ran. Harkova, what's the case of Harkova? That's not, we have a Mishnah in Shvi'it. Ein notin, ve'ein mavrichin, ve'ein markivin erv Shvi'it, pachot mishlushim yom lifnei Rosh Hashanah. One is not allowed to plant, one is not allowed to be mavrich or markiv. These are two different terminologies. One of them, markiv, is to graft. You're not allowed to graft a tree on Erev Shvi'it within 30 days of Rosh Hashanah. Ve'en mavrichin is from the word berech. That's the easiest way to remember. It's a knee. It's the taking of an existing tree, vine, or something that is growing, taking one of the branches or vines, and then reinserting it in the ground and pulling it up somewhere else so that it would take root on its own and it'll grow on its own, but it's still attached to the main tree. And the question of later on, can you sever it? That's called mavrichin. So these are just three different forms of planting a tree. We're literally planting it in the ground, grafting it, or creating an offshoot of the tree. All three of these, Erev Shvi'it, are problematic. Pachot mishloshim yom lifnei Rosh Hashanah. Within 30 days of Rosh Hashanah is problematic. Ve'im nata, ve'hivrich, ve'irkiv. If he did any of these, melachot, ya'akor. He has to uproot it. He has to undo it. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, kol harkava, she'enu koletet. Bishlosh yamim shuv eina koletet. Anything that doesn't take root within 3 days will not take root at all. 3 days is the time period for taking root. If something doesn't take root within 3 days, it's not going to survive. It will never survive. Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, Reim Shtei Shabbatot. That din is 2 weeks. It has 2 weeks to root. If it doesn't take root within 2 weeks, it won't be a viable tree. This is Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon that we're speaking about, is Shtei Shabbatot. Then we have a qualification of the statement. Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rabbi Barvua, the Divrei Amir Shloshim. The one who says you need 30 days here, which is the Tana Kama. Tzirich Shloshim v'Shloshim. You need 30 and 30. The Divrei Amir Shlosha. The one who says you need 3 days for kolected, for it to take root. Tzirich Shlosha v'Shloshim. You need 33 days. The Divrei Amir Shtei Shabbatot. Rabbi Yosi and Rabbi Shimon say you need 2 weeks. Tzirich Shtei Shabbatot to Shloshim Yom. You need the 30 plus the 2 weeks. So what is being said over here is not clear. And that's a machloket Rashi and Tosafot, and a much broader machloket, which is, here we're talking about Erev Shvi'it. What is the problem going to Erev Shvi'it? Rashi says what seemingly is the obvious answer. It's Tosefet Shvi'it. There's a requirement of Tosefet Shvi'it, and you have to avoid overriding or ruining that Tosefet Shvi'it. You know, Tosefet Shvi'it is built up of different component parts. We learned this together in Moed Katan, as well in other places where we discuss Shvi'it, which is that there is a law called the Moshe Misinai, that the 30 days before Shvi'it, you cannot do the work that would otherwise be asur on Shvi'it itself. The Chachamim, which is Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, discussed this. There was a takana that moved back to Tosefet Shvi'it, back to Atzeret, roughly, and to Pesach for Tzvuah. Pesach is the harvest for the previous year's Tfuah. So therefore, from Pesach onward, there's no working the field. And then for trees, Atzeret, Shavuot is the harvest of the fruit, and that's why Bikurim come from Atzeret. So that part of Atzeret is the stopping point for when you can work a field that is full of trees. So therefore, they extended back to Tosefet Shvi'it, back to Shavuot and Pesach, Pesach for Tfuah, for grains, and for trees, back to Atzeret. So then you have the 30 days of Lachal Moshe Misinai. Then Rabbi Gamil Beit Dino came and then erased or took away the Takanot, that Beit Hillel Beit Shammai, that were back to Atzeret and Pesach. How they did that, the Gemara discusses, because usually you can't have a Beit Din come and be okay, or something that a Beit Din that was greater than them and before them did. The Gemara says that Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai built the Takanah with an automatic out in it. They built the Takanah in such a way that a Beit Din after them could come and undermine it. So they do that. Then you have the 30 days. The question of the 30 days is much more complex for a number of reasons. One is that it's halacha l'Moshe Misinai and seemingly only applies when the Beit HaMikdash is extant. When there's no Beit HaMikdash, then the 30-day rule does not apply. It only applies when there is a Beit HaMikdash. The question of how that's implied in the halacha l'Moshe Misinai, was the halacha l'Moshe Misinai in that way? It was stated as it's only relevant during the Beit HaMikdash, or is it only relevant when Shemitah is d'oraita? How it's associated with Shemitah itself is a question. So then, this 30-day window of Tosefet Shvi'it, first of all, what is the problem with regards to Tosefet Shvi'it? Why aren't you allowed to work the land during the Tosefet Shvi'it? Do we say, and this is a question, for instance, when you have Tosefet Shabbat, when you add on to Shabbat, what's the nature of the Tosefet Shabbat that you have? Here, it's a slightly different nature because the Isur could be of Tosefet Shvi'it is that anything you're doing during that period of time that is Tosefet Shvi'it or prior to Shvi'it is really just prepping the land for what you would do during the Shvi'it. So we're not going to allow you to prep the land and take care of all these things going into Shvi'it because the only reason to do it, why would you plow the field on Erev Shvi'it except if you're going to plant on Shvi'it? You're not going to plant on Shvi'it, there's no reason to plow the land now. And so that plowing is clearly a preparation for Shvi'it. So Tosefet Shvi'it says don't do anything that is a preparation for the Shvi'it year because that's exactly what you're doing. You're prepping the land for Shvi'it, and you're not going to do anything with it on Shvi'it. So that's what Tosefet Shvi'it comes and says, don't do that. Obviously, in that case, if you're doing something that is taking care of the previous year, or doing something to take care of what is already on the vine or planted, maybe there would be no application of Tosefet Shvi'it to that item. The other possibility is that Tosefet Shvi'it is preventative in nature, which is that we don't let you work during Tosefet Shvi'it so that you don't come to work during the Shvi'it itself, which is that Tosefet Shvi'it says, don't work now, have a buffer between you and Shvi'it so that you don't come to do it or you're reminded of not doing anything on Shvi'it because we already pulled you out way before. If you're working all the way down to Erev Rosh Hashanah, then you stop all of a sudden. People are going to may have stuff invested in the land. They've done a lot, and then they're going to just continue into Shvi'it. If we block you out when Tosefet Shvi'it, which basically says, what's the new year already, the new planting season or the preparations for the new planting season, you won't forget to not do it on Shvi'it itself. The other possibility of Tosefet Shvi'it is things that you do during Tosefet Shvi'it will have ramifications on Shvi'it. It will cause things to grow, cause things to happen on Shvi'it. So therefore, Tosefet Shvi'it is not just you're prepping the land, but you're doing things that are going to promote growth on the Shvi'it, are going to promote change during the Shvi'it, which we don't want. Because then you're really, in the end, the work is being done for something that will happen and really be manifest on the Shvi'it. It's not just preparations to plant on the Shvi'it. The plowing itself will cause the tree to grow better during the Shvi'it. So maybe the Tosefet Shvi'it is preventing you from doing melachot that will have their result be felt on the Shvi'it. So those are all different ways to view this Tosefet Shvi'it as to what the problem is. Rashi claims over here, and this is what Fred, you were asking, Rashi claims over here that the 30-day addition that was mentioned at the end, the qualification, is Tosefet Shvi'it. Says there's 30 days of Tosefet Shvi'it. That 30 days of Tosefet Shvi'it is then added on to whatever you think it takes to root. So you need to have the tree root before that 30 days of Tosefet Shvi'it takes hold. So then again, all these cases are, you have, if you say 30 days, that means you need 30 days for it to take root, plus the 30 days of Tosefet Shvi'it. That's why you have 60 days. If you hold 3 days, then it's, you need 3 days for it to take root, and then the 30 days of Tosefet Shvi'it, and the same with the 2 weeks, the Shtei Shabbatot. That is the way that Rashi learns. Tosafot disagrees. He says, Perish Rabbeinu Tam, the lava Shvi'it Koi. Says that it's not talking about Shvi'it, because the Inyan Nitiyah ain't Tosefet Shvi'it. There's an exception to the rule when it comes to the Nitiyah, that it has to be a sapling that is planted in a certain manner. That is one of the exceptions to the rule of the Halacha Moshe Misinai, which is you're allowed to take care of those trees up until Erev Rosh Hashanah. So there is a out from Tosefet Shvi'it, even Midoraita, for saplings that are being noteya, they have to be planted a certain amount, 10 in a certain Beitza'ah, and spread out in a exact manner, but there you have the right to work, to even plow the field, to do anything you need. Tosefet Shvi'it means anything that you wouldn't do at Shvi'it. So here you can do anything you need for these trees all the way up to Erev Shvi'it. So Tosefet says this can never be talking, it's definitely not talking about Tosefet Shvi'it, because this is one of the exceptions to the rule, which you're allowed to work, and Tosefet Shvi'it doesn't apply to it. So then why do you need this 30-day buffer? He says because of Orla. The problem of Orla, before Shvi'it, problem is that you need a certain amount of time for the tree to be classified as a year, or taking up a full year of Orla. So the minimum amount for a year is 30 days, because Shloshim Yom B'Shana is Chashuv Shana. So if you planted more than 30 days before Shvi'it, then you counted 1 year towards the years of Orla for your tree, because then you hit Rosh Hashanah, and then you've now crossed over into your second year, in terms of the sapling. Right, so in terms of the din of Orla, for the nature of the tree, you count from Rosh Hashanah as to what year you're in. For the fruits on the tree, for it switched from a sapling, from a Orla to a non-Orla, Rosh Hashanah is the Koveya. For the fruits, the governing is Tu Bishvat. So even though you hit your third year, you can't eat the fruits until you've crossed over the fruits that are after Tu Bishvat of that third year. But you need to know which year is the third year before you go to the Tu Bishvat. So that year is governed. It's governed by Rosh Hashanah, whereas the fruits are governed by Tu Bishvat. So if you plant more than 30 days before Rosh Hashanah, that previous year will count as a year. So the 3 years, the first year will be year number 6, the second year will be 7, and the third year will be year 1 of the next Shemitah cycle. And then again, because of Tu Bishvat, you won't be able to eat the fruits probably in the second year of that Shemitah cycle. But if we didn't insist that you planted more than 30 days before Shvi'it, what would happen? You put the tree in the ground, and then the first year would not be Shishit because you don't have enough time. That means your first year will be Shvi'it. So you count out. Shvi'it's your first year. First year of the Shemitah cycle is your second. Second year of the Shemitah cycle is your third year. So now in the third year, the person says it's up for, Orla is done. And then in the next year, you'll be able to eat the fruits. Then people are going to start saying, wait a minute. This is your Revi year? That means that you planted on the Shvi'it. Now, even though he didn't plant on the Shvi'it, but it will look like he planted on the Shvi'it because that was the first year of his Orla. So therefore, we didn't want that to be a problem. You have to make sure that you have a buffer of 30 days before to make sure that it is planted on 6th year and not considered to be planted on the 7th year. Again, if you planted during that period of time, there's nothing wrong. You didn't necessarily do anything wrong, excluding Tosefet Shvi'it. If there's no Tosefet Shvi'it, the buffer of 30 days is to ensure that this is a Shishit tree and not a Shvi'it tree. And that's the way the Rabbeinu Tam learns over here, that we're talking about Orla, not about Shvi'it. And that's what the 30-day buffer is for, to ensure that you get a Shana, a full year in beforehand. So you need the tree to root before the 30 days start. So you get a 30-day count for the year. And that's the machloka here. If you need 30 days for it to root, you need 30 days plus 30 days. If you need 3 days for it to root, you need 3 days plus 30 days. And in addition, if you told 2 weeks, you need 2 weeks plus 30 days. All right, that's the next case where we say Alocha ke Rabbi Yossi, which is that it's 2 weeks, Shtei Shabbatot, in order for it to take root. Alright. Shmuel Amar. Shmuel added on these two additional items, which were Koshi and Kiddush. What are they? Koshi Ditnan. Koshi is Kamihei Kishuya. How much time does she have in terms of her birth pangs? This has to do with a woman who is pregnant. A woman who's pregnant is usually Mutsuleket Damim. She doesn't see Dam. If she does see Dam during her pregnancy, even though she has been Mutsuleket Dam, we still count her cycle of Nida and Ziva. Midoraita, a woman is Tmeya Tumat Nida for 7 days. Then she has her 11 days of Yumei Ziva. During her 7 days of Nida, if she sees Dam, she's a Nida. And she has to wait until the end of that 7 day period, and then she goes to the mikveh and she's Teorah. If she has sightings during her Yumei Ziva, the 11 days of Yumei Ziva, she sees 1 day, she has to be Shomer the next day, Betara. If she sees 2 days, the 3rd day, she has to keep Betara. She sees 3 days in a row, she becomes a Zavah G'dolah, and she needs Shiva Nikiim. If she sees Dam during her pregnancy, she has to still count these 7 days and 11 day periods cycling through her pregnancy to know if she sees Dam during the pregnancy, that Dam is either Dam Nida or Dam Ziva. And then we'd have to figure out whether she can get Shiva Nikiim in or not. So that all applies during her pregnancy. But there is a rule by Zava, or Zava Gdola, that the dam she sees, the blood she sees, that's because of her, and not because of another cause. It can't be an exogenous cause like a baby, or a birth. If she's seeing dam during birth, that's called dam leida, not dam ziva. How do I know whether it's dam ziva or dam leida? That's the question that the Mishnah is dealing with, which is, which dam is dam leida, and which dam is dam ziva? How much before her birth is it still considered to be dam leida? If she starts to have birth pangs or contractions going into the birth and has sightings of blood, is that blood of ziva? Or is that blood of leida? How do I know? So that's the discussion of this Mishnah. Rav Meir Omer, arba'im u'chamishim yom, up to 40 or 50 days prior to, I would call it the due date, or the time that the baby is born, all that dam can be classified as dam of leida, not dam of ziva. Rav Yehuda Omer, daya chodsha. The month before is enough. What that means exactly is not clear, but daya chodesha means it seems like that month in which she gives birth, she can go back to Rosh Chodesh. So she gives birth in the early part of the month. She only gets a couple of days. If she gives birth in the latter half of the month, she gets the whole period of the month. But in addition to that, Rashi explains over here that she has to see it 3 days in a row, meaning that it has to be a sequential sighting of blood. It can't be split up. There are all these other rules, again, that are important to the Mishnah, but not important to our Gemara here. Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, again, here we have Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, Omrim, Ein Kishu Yoter Mishtei Shabbatot. You can't associate the blood or the sightings with the birth more than 2 weeks beforehand. 2 weeks beforehand, those contractions, those sightings of blood are associated with the birth. Before that already, they were Dam Nida or Dam Ziva. They're definitely not connected to Dam Leida. Dam Leida is Tohora. The woman is then Tmeyah for 7 days or 14 days, and then she goes into her period of Tahara. But what we do today is that there's a fear that the woman gave birth with a either b'ziva or b'nida, and that she had a setting of nida or ziva at the time of her leida, and we can't catch it. And so because of that, we make the woman into a nida, coming in through pregnancy, and she can't get out of the problem, because today with nida, we need shiva nikiim, which is a leida b'ziva, and there's no way a woman can get shiva nikiim for roughly up to 3 months, or even up to 6 months after she gives birth, because she continues to have sightings of dam from the leida, which prevent her ability to then get shiva nikiim. So the woman remains tmeyaha all the way through that period. Not like the din deoraita, but because of this ashash that we have midrabanan, the woman is basically tmeyaha asura lebala for a good 3 to 6 months after she gives birth because of this chashash that she gave birth b'ziva, gave birth b'nida. But miikar alocha, midoraita, the dam leida is dam leida. It only requires to be tmeyaha for 7 days for a male, 14 for a female. And then after that, all the dam she's seeing is tohora, and she doesn't have any issue. She's completely muteret lebala, and she is not tmeya anymore. Again, we are choshesh that there was leida b'ziva, leida b'nida, and therefore we don't allow that to happen, so we never get her into a point of tahara. All right, so now next is kiddush. What's kiddush? The Tanan, a Mishnah in Kilayim. Ha-misachech gafno agabei tvuato shel chaveiro. Someone who basically drops his vines across the grain of his friend. He spreads his vines out over like a lattice work or over a gazebo, but he's doing, instead of doing it over a gazebo or a lattice work, he drops it on top of his friend's wheat field in order to support his vines. Harizei kiddush, kiddush, by the way, by kilayim is the term that is used in the Torah, and therefore kiddush over here means it makes it asur, it makes it into kilaya kerem. That's the word that's used in the Torah. Rabbi Meir says, you caused the problem, but now you're responsible for the problem. Yes, you can make it problematic, you make it asur, but now that you did that, you're chayab to repay the individual for destroying his crop. You basically made his crop all asur ba'ana'ah, you gotta pay for it. Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, again, omrim, ein adam oser davar sheino shelo. You can't ruin somebody else's stuff. You don't have the right to make his things asur because of kilay akerem. Now this is not such a simple statement because that's just not true. If you go into someone's kitchen, they got some chicken soup cooking on the broth going on the stovetop. You drop a piece of cheese in there, you ruined his chicken soup. And we don't say, oh, you can't ruin someone else's stuff. So Tosfos takes up the issue. He says, Vim tomar, maishnami tonotein tevela, ochele betavshil shechavero, shenesar. What's that any different? That you ruined someone else's pot. You put in a vela, you put in chaleb, you put in chalav. Whatever it is that you put into their pot, you can ruin it. There's no problem with that. Tosfos differentiates and says, it's only in cases where machshava matters, where your thought process matters. When it's a sin of thought, then we say that you cannot ruin your friend's things. So for instance, the case in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, where a person bows down to his friend's animal and makes his friend's animal into an Avodah Zarah. He can't change the animal into Avodah Zarah. It's not your animal. And it's all about machshava. Machshava there is that you're making this animal into a god. That already you can't do because you're affecting your friend's property through machshava. So that you can't do. On the other hand, when it's a maaseh, when you're dropping in a vela, or you're putting something physically into the pot, there you can affect your friend's items. So over here, Tosfos proves that kilayim also has to do with machshava, which is it has to do with intent. If you intend to move, or as an instance, you're putting up a fence between your vines and your crops, as long as you're working on the fence, they're considered to be separate, even if they grow in the interim. So you see that machshava matters. If you already had yeyush and you're not going to put up the fence, then they become asur when they grow. So you see your machshava impacts with regards to kilaya kerem. What you're thinking or what you're planning on doing impacts. And therefore over here, this is also an aveira that involves machshava. And because of that, he cannot be osa davar sheino shelo. He's physically moving the vine over the wheat, but kilaya kerem involves an aspect of intent. So if you intend to put up a wall there and you're moving a wall through, then you could... No, kilaya kerem is not about a grafting between the two of them. Simply that they are next to each other. They are, right, both proximity, but mostly about they are taking nourishment from the same space. So they're close enough where they're drawing their nutrition from the same space in the ground. So it's a iser. Kilayim is a chok. It depends, okay. It depends on the source, but there's a secondary problem, which is that if they're mi'urbav, if they're mixed together, that not only is there a problem in proximity in the ground, but there's also a problem if they grow onto each other and they're mu'rbav together, then there's a separate issue of kilayim. Alright, so Yibailo, bandroginos, mali amar Shmuel. With regards to an androginos, what is Shmuel's position? Because again, Shmuel only said that alokas gerab yosi, be koshi, ube kiddush. What about androginos, where Rav said alokas gerab yosi? Tashma, damar Shmuel the Ravanan, letter the bright to me kami matnitan. So we already saw that Shmuel says to Rabbanan that the Braita doesn't hold water in front of the Mishnah. So there it's clear that Shmuel thinks that the Mishnah governs, whereas Rav thinks that the Braita governs. So either you have to read like Rashi, which means he means Halacha Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon, it means he holds like Rav, that the Halacha is like Rabbi Yossi of the Mishnah. Or if you say that Rav said Halacha is Rabbi Yossi in the Braita, then he's not like Rav. He's saying Halacha is like Rabbi Yossi of the Mishnah, not like Rabbi Yossi of the Braita. So depending on how you read the Halacha Rabbi Yossi originally about androgynous will depend on what you think Shmuel is saying over here. Harkova Mali, Amar Shmuel. Again, by Harkova, what does Shmuel say? We only had that by Rav. Tashma, Damar Le Shmuel Ravanan, Tznei, Kemanda Amar Shlosha Vishloshim. You should paskin, or you should say it over like the one who says 33, which is not the opinion. Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon's opinion was 2 weeks, Shtei Shabbatot, not 3 days. So therefore it's clear that there he disagrees with Rav. So it's seemingly over here, Shmuel disagrees with those two positions of Rav, and therefore, that's why he didn't mention them. But now, Koshi, Mali Amar Rav. Koshi, what would Rav say about Shmuel's statement about Koshi? Teiku, we have no proof, we don't know what Rav says about that. Kiddush, Mali Amar Rav. By this Kilayim issue, what does Rav say? Amar Rav Yosef, Tashma, Damar Rav Huna, Amar Rav. Ein Olocha ki Rabbi Yosi. Because now you have Rav Huna saying the name of Rav, the Olocha is not like Rabbi Yosi. Why are you relying on Rav Huna to say that Aloha is not like Rabbi Yossi in that case? Why don't you rely on this? that Rav Avda says the name of Rav, the halacha is like Rabbi Yossi. So how do you know which one governs? You have two Amoraim saying the name of Rav, one says halacha is like Rabbi Yossi, one saying halacha is not like Rabbi Yossi. Mar says here, and this is what I was mentioning before, Amrei Bei Rav, Manu, who is Bei Rav? Ravuna. Ravuna is always the one who's considered Bei Rav. Ravuna Amar in halacha. Meaning that Ravuna is the Talmud Muvak of Rav. When they just give a stam statement of Bei Rav, that is Ravuna. So if you're going to rely on someone who's quoting Rav, you're going to rely on Ravuna. Because if Ravuna is considered to be the stam Bei Rav, then when Ravuna says something in Rav's name, he's given a lot more weight than someone else quoting Rav because of his status as being Bei Rav. So over here, this is where Rashi raises the issue in Sanhedrin, which is that the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that it's Rav Hamnuna, not Ravuna. So this is where Rashi says that when it's Ravuna quoting it, then it's Rav Hamnuna. But when it's just Bei Rav by itself, it's Ravuna. Tosfot says that can't be the case because Rav Huna is a Talmud of Rav. Rav Chista is a Talmud Chover of Rav Huna. Rav Hamnuna is a Talmud Chover of Rav Chista. So there's no way that Rav Huna would be quoting something in the name of Rav Hamnuna. So why would it? It's like almost like a grand Talmud in a sense because he's already two generations later, even though he comes to Talmud Chover of Rav Chista, but Rav Chista is a Talmud Chover of Rav Huna. So why would Rav Huna ever be quoting Rav Hamnuna? It seems not possible. And therefore, how could you say that it's Rav Huna speaking and quoting Rav Hamnuna as Bei Rav? So that's why he rejects it. Then, Tosfot does here what he does in many places in Shas. He says there's another Rav Hamnuna. There are actually two Rav Hamnunas. There's a Rav Hamnuna who is a Talmud of Rav, a direct Talmud of Rav, and then there's a Rav Hamnuna who is a Talmud Chover of Rav Chista. And therefore, you can reconcile that that Rav Hamnuna was the direct Talmud of Rav, and those are the two different Rav Hamnunas over here. Now, the Rabbeinu Tam rejects the explanation of the Rashi, and the Rabbeinu Tam Mefarish that Ela Rav Hamnuna perish b'chol makom shetimza Rav Huna amei bei Rav lo temer Rav Huna ela ema amar Rav Hamnuna amar bei Rav. Anytime you hear that Rav Huna says amrei bei Rav, don't leave it as Rav Huna bei Rav because bei Rav is Rav Huna. So it can't be Rav Huna quoting Rav Huna. Change it to Rav Hamnuna quoting bei Rav, which means Rav Hamnuna is quoting Rav Huna, which would make sense. So that's how the Rabbeinu Tam explains it. But just so you know that the Gemara here has to be reconciled with that in Sanhedrin about what the Bei Rav is. Is it Rav Huna? Is it Rav Hamnuna? And then how do you deal with that? Now the Gemara says, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, we're moving on to the next section of the Mishnah, which is Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Tumtum Shenikra. Tumtum that is ripped open, he has a din of a Saris Chama. I'm Rabbi Ami. My Ovid Le Rabbi Yehuda, the Tumtum, the Beri. What did Rabbi Yehuda do to this Tumtum from a place called Beri? The Odvua Bei Kurse. He put him on his chair, V'ikra, and he ripped him over, and V'olid Sheva Banim, and he gave birth to seven children. First of all, a Bei Kurse, he put him on his seat, it's not clear what that means. Right? Most translate it as to mean that he put him on his surgery chair, which is, that was the chair for surgery, and then they cut him open to expose his sexual parts, and then they realized that he was a Zachar. Then he went on and acted like a Zachar, got married, and had kids. So now Rabbi Yehuda says in the Mishnah that if you open up the Tumtum, you find that he's a Zachar, he's considered to be a Sris Chama. He's congenitally unable to reproduce. Over here we have evidence of the fact that a Tumtum was ripped open and he has seven children afterwards. So what's Rabbi Yehuda going to do with that? He said, no problem. Rabbi Yehuda Amarlei, Chazer Albanav, Ma'ayin Heim. That's exactly what Rabbi Yehuda says. Check out where this guy's kids are from because they're certainly not from him. That means that there's some extramarital activity going on over here and these kids are Mamzerim. So Rabbi Yehuda Lashit Tadav would say that these are not his kids, and therefore you have to figure out who really is the father of these children. Tanyo, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, so this is the son of Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda says, Tumtum lo yachlots, Tumtum shena tu chalitza, shemi yikra v'nimtza siris chama, because maybe it'll be opened up and found to be a siris chama. Atu kol demikare zachar havi, that the assumption means that anytime you open up a Tumtum, he's going to be a male. And then, well, maybe he'll be a Sris Chama when you open him up. Wait a minute. How do you know that he's a male to start with? That's the whole problem with Tumtum. So when it's Hachi Kamar, this is what it's meant. Shema Ikara. So maybe you will rip him open. Vindim sa Nekeva. That's one possibility. You'll open him up and he'll be fine as a Nekeva. So obviously then he can't be Choleitz because he's a female, not a male. V'afilo Nimsa Zachar. Even if you open up and found him to be a male, Shema Yimatzei Sris Chama. Maybe he'll be found to be a Sris Chama. And therefore, he will also be pasul from performing the chalitza, because he's a sris chama. So now, my binayu. What's the difference between Rabbi Yehuda and his son, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda? Because they both say you can't do chalitza. Both say that don't do chalitza. Rabbi Yehuda says don't do chalitza because maybe he'll be opened up and be found to be a zachar and he's a sris chama. Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yudah says, maybe it'll be Nekeva, maybe it'll be Zachar and Zvizchama, but you can't, according to both of them, you can't do Chalitza. So Amarava, Bifsol b'makom achim, v'lachlot shelo b'makom achim, ike ben ayu. To be in Pasul, where there are other brothers, or to do Chalitza, where there are no other brothers. So let's do the first one, the Bifsol b'makom achim is, if you have other brothers there, and then the Tumtum goes ahead and performs Chalitza. He does something with the Yivama that's waiting there. What is the impact of his action? Does he now make it that this woman is now psula for all of the other brothers? Has he now disqualified this Yivama? Well, according to Rabbi Yehuda, that he makes him into a Vadai Sris Chama, then his action has no impact whatsoever. It's not an efficacious Chalitza. And if that's the case, then she's still Yivama, and the other brothers can act on her. Her status never changed. According to Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, who says it's a Safek, the reason we don't let him do Chalitza is because it's a fake. That same Safek will impact the Yivama now and make her a Surah to the other brothers. Because it's Misafek, we don't allow him to do it. But that means it could have impact. It could be possible that he had impact over here. As well as Lachlot, Shalom, Makom, Machim. If there are no other brothers besides this individual, according to Rabbi Yehuda, no Chalitza. Because he's disqualified completely from this. He's a Vadai, Swiss Chama, and therefore he doesn't do Chalitza at all. Other than, according to Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, he's going to have to Misafek, do Chalitza, because there's a possibility that he could be a kasher brother. So that's the difference between them. Amar Rav Shmuel bar Yehuda, Amar Rav Abba, Achua Durav Yehuda bar Zabdi. So Rav Shmuel bar Yehuda says in the name of Rabbi Abba, who's the brother of Rabbi Yehuda bar Zabdi, Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav. So here we're quoting. We're quoting Rav Yehuda in the name of Rav. Androgynous, chaynalav skila mishtei mekomot. Hey, androgynous, you are chayav skila if the person has a sexual intercourse with him, meaning Mishkav Zachar, that there's some sort of homosexual act, sodomy, that takes place over here. That doesn't matter if it's his male side or his female side. If you interact with either of them, that is a problem. If a Zachar interacts with either of them, it's a problem. What about our Mishnah? Rabbi Lezer Amar, Androgynous, Chayvin Alav Skilak Ib Zachar. That Rabbi Lezer says in our Mishnah that Androgynous, you only Chayav Skilak for Mishkav Zachar when he's a Zachar, when he acts like a Zachar. When is that true? That's only if you're using his male organs for this. But if it's his female organs, it's patur, obviously of a sur, but it's still patur. It's not governed by the restriction against homosexuality. So who do Amar ki ay tana? He holds like the other tana. The tanya, Rabbi Simai Omer, androgynous chayav skila mishtei mekomot. That you're chayav skila like Mishkav Zachar from both locations. It's also true before that the Gemara said that marks the nafkamina between the position of Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer was the last line in our Mishnah. The one before of that, the androgynous nosei benu nisa, we said both of them seem to indicate it's a vadai zachar. The Gemara said, ma yikam in ayu, what's the difference between them? The Gemara said, whether you're chayav from shtei mekomot to makom achad. So technically the Gemara could have quoted from Rabbi Yossi as being that position. Why the Gemara didn't do that is because they're looking for someone to say it explicitly. Over here, Rabbi Simai says it explicitly, so they're trying to find an attribution that they can say explicitly says that Mishkav Zachar is problematic, both with his Tzad Zachar and Tzad Yunkeva. So my time with Rabbi Simai, what's the reasoning behind Rabbi Simai's position here that you're chayav both from your part Tzad Zachar and Yunkeva by androgynous? Amar Rava, Rava says, Barham Dure Asabroli, Barham Dure explained to me, V'et Zachar lo tishkav mishkevei isha. Ezu Zachar sheish bo shnei mishkevot. Says, you may not sleep with a zachar, mishkevei, mishkevei in the plural, isha. So you can't act with a zachar with shtei mishkevot. Well, which zachar, who has a classification like a zachar, still has both male and female organs, has the possibility of two mishkevot with him? That is an androgynous. Avi Omer, ze androgynous. And therefore, you're chayav in both locations. V'rabbanan, what did the rabbanan who argue on him say? Avagav did be shtei mishkevot et zachar ktiv. The beginning of the pasuk says, ve'et zachar. So despite the fact that he has mishkevei isha, nevertheless he's only chayav for et zachar, for that which is the male version. So he's only chayav in mishkav zachar if he acts like a male. Rabbanan zachar greido minolahu. Well, now that they use the pasuk up for this, how do they know about a zachar what the restriction is in a homosexual act? I mean that we thought that mishkevei isha comes to teach you what act that he does is that's going to be mechayev him. Now that you used up mishkevei isha and the word zachar to talk about an androgynous, then where do you know just a regular zachar? How do you know about it? So he says, "Word me isha, be isha shelo kedarka min alahu." Then how do we also know that by isha shelo kedarka is kedarka, where one has biyah with a woman shelo kedarka, as far as arayot are concerned, as far as many of the lachot of biyah are concerned, The din of Shelo Kedarka is the same as the din of Kedarka. How do we know that? Well, we originally thought we learned that at Mishkevei Isha, which was that there are multiple ways to engage with a woman. But you already used that for another limud. So where do you get that from? V'isha. No, V'isha doesn't exist in the Pasuk. So you can see over here that the girsa of the Bach is V'et Isha, which is V'et Zachar. It's really the V'et at the beginning of the Pasuk. Some people actually switch it around. If you look in the bet of the Bach, he switches around the girsa and says, we learn out the Zachar from the Ve'et, and we learn out the Isha from the Isha, which would make a little more sense. So he reverses the Limudim, but the Limudim are the extra Vav from Ve'et Zachar, and from Isha. So they have two extra Limudim that are there, and therefore they learn all of these halachot from that Pasuk. Number one, which is that an androgynous is only Chayab b'makom Zichrut, because that's Ve'et Zachar from the word Mishkevei. We know that an Isha is chayevet from both locations because of either Mishkevei Isha, the word Isha, or from Ve'et, the extra Vav in the beginning. We also know that a Zachar, how is a homosexual act the problem, is either from, again, the word Isha or Ve'et, one of those two teaches us that limud. Amrav Shizvi, Amrav Chista, lo lokol amar Rabbi Lezer androgynous Zachar ma'al Yehu. Rabbi Lezer doesn't say an androgynous is a full-fledged Zachar. She'im atal merkein, if you do say that, be'mukdashin yigdash. Because then, when it comes to korbanot, he should be able to read mikadesh such a thing. So Gemara says, "We now learn to lo kadosh." How do you know that it doesn't work? So he says, "The Tanur of Banan, we have a brayta on nirba va'muksa va'nevad." So here, a nirba, an animal that had bestiality performed with it, a muksa, something that is designated as takrovit for avodah zarah, va'nevad, an animal that was worshipped. Vetnan is an animal that was exchanged for the services of a harlot. Omechir is mechir kelev; it was exchanged for a dog. The tumtum androgynous, and an animal that has either of these problems, we're not aware of what its sexual orientation is, or we have both sexual parts that are there. Mitamim bigadim abeit abliya. If you swallow it, you will then be mitamei bigadim abeit abliya. This is what we call nevelat of tahor. Of tahor, birds that are kosher, they don't have tumat nevela associated with them. The only problem they have is if you swallow them. If you eat them, then they're mitamei beit abliya. When it reaches the back of the mouth, the throat, when you're swallowing it, it makes you tamei, it makes your clothing tamei. Just coming into contact with it does not make it tamei. These animals were all brought as korbanot in the mikdash. They are korbanot that are psulim. They're not korbanot that you can bring on the mizbeach. But in the mikdash, how do you shecht an oaf? You pop its head off from melika, you do it from the back. Melika is not shchita. Shchita is mitaher animals from being nevela. You know, if you shecht an animal, it's found to be a treifa, then it's a treifa, not a nevela. If an animal dies naturally or is killed in a different way besides shchita, then it's a nevela. So nevelat of tahor, if you had done shchita on it, it would not be a nevelat of tahor. But now you did malika, malika doesn't qualify outside the mikdash. Since these are not good korbanot, the malika here makes it into a nevela, nevelat of tahor. But what do you see here? This is a list of korbanot that are disqualified. In that list is tumtum and androgynous. Think Rabbi Lez Omer? Tumtum va androgynous emetamim begadim ebet abliya. He leaves those out. He says, Tumtum and androgynous are out of this. She'a Rabbi Lez Omer kol makom shenema zachar unikeva. Anytime there's a demand for zachar or nikeva in the Torah, Adam would say tumtum androgynous vivinayam. Then they're excluded. Tumtum and androgynous are excluded. They're not considered to be a zachar. They're not considered to be a nikeva. So if you have a demand for zachar nikeva, if you have a demand for which sex it is, it's a male or female, then androgynous and tumtum don't qualify. But va'of. By oaf, the birds in the Torah, Sefer Vayikra, it never demands a zachar nekeva. Never makes any demand about which min it is. So Rabbi Lezer says birds are an exception to this rule. Birds are an exception because there's no demand for zachar nekeva. But implied in his statement is that by behemoth, there is a differentiation. But didn't Rabbi Lezer in our mission say that an androgynous is a zachar, is a male? If it's a male, then why by an animal? Is it also not a male? And therefore it should qualify as a zachar for korban. So that's what the statement that we just saw now, which is that, obviously, Rav Chista says, Rabbi Elazar doesn't think an androgynous is zachar for everything. He's a zachar for certain things, but he's not a complete zachar over here. Right, and again, this might relate to the machloket earlier, as well as the machloket about, from how many points is he considered to be a zachar, which is, what is the status of an androgynous? Is the status of an androgynous, he's a complete zachar, and therefore, if you engage with him, whether it's you engage with his nikevot, or his Zichrut, you're going to be chayav because he's a complete zachar. Or, like Rabbi Eliezer suggests, and this is what's being suggested in Rabbi Eliezer's position, is that you're only chayav from makom zichrut, which is that his male member and his male parts are going to be governed like a male. But his nekevu is also going to remain. There's a residual safek of nekeva that is embedded in him. And because of that, you now have it. You have a residual issue within this zachar, which is going to cause problem by korbanot. And it's going to cause problems in other areas or going to give him a definition. And that's what Rav Chisda said here. Those that hold that you're only chayav from makom zichrut view the nekevut as being something that is not subject to the rules of him being a zachar. It still leaves him with a side nekeva to him that causes problems by korbanot and also excludes him from the problem of mishkav zachar. Alright. Amar Rav Nachman Yitzhak. Af anan nami tanina. We also have a Tanaic work that supports this, which is Rabbi Eliezer Omer. Hakil ayim. Utrefa v'yotzei dofen tumtum v'androgynous lo kadoshim v'lo mikadshim. They cannot become kadosh, and then they cannot make other things kadosh. V'amar Shmuel lo kadoshim b'tmura. Tmura is not manifest on them. V'lo mikadshim b'osei tmura, and they cannot make other things tmura. The Gemara there asks the obvious question, which is if they can't become kadosh, how do they make something else kadosh b'tmura? So the Gemara says that in a case where they are born with the defect in them, because their mother was already kadosh, then the child or the baby is automatically kadosh from birth. So that's a case of ladot kodoshim, is the case where they can come up or have these cases. Now, these are different list of problems here. It's not the same list as before. That list before, if you're mekadesh the animal, the kedusha is tofes, and they are pasul to go on the mizbeach, but when you're mekadesh them, they have kedusha aguf. So by Nevad, Nirba, Roveya, Muksa, Nevad, all those, if you Mekadesh them, they take on Kedusha Aguf, they just can't be put on the Mizbeach. And then you have to wait for a Mom, and then you redeem them. Over here, these ones that are listed in this list are not only not able to become Korbanot, they're not even able to be Tofes Kedusha Aguf. If you Mekadesh them, it's like being Mekadesh a tree. It's equivalent of just donating them for their monetary worth, not for their going on the Mizbeach or Kodshim. So therefore, you don't need a Mom, you can redeem them right away. So that's why this list is different than the previous list. But in this list, you have kilayim, trefa, yotzei dofen. Kilayim is a mixed breed. Trefa is obviously a problem. There it's machloket about what the din of trefa is. But yotzei dofen is a C-section, a cesarean section. Tomtom androgynous. All of those are lo kedoshim and lo mekadshim. So you see there's a Mishnah that says that they are disqualified from being kodoshim. They can't make something tmura and they can't receive tmura. Why tmura? Because to make something kadosh from the beginning is much harder. Tmura is chal, even on a bal mum. If you have a bal mum, an animal that's a bal mum, and you try to be mekadesh it, it doesn't work. If you have a bal mum, and you try to do tmura, exchange tmura, a kodesh onto it, it does work. So you see that the tmura has more power than initial kodesh. So tmura is manifest even on things that are otherwise psulim to go on the mizbeach. So you would have thought over here that tmura would take effect on these animals that normally are disqualified. They have mumim that disqualify them. Maybe it should take effect on them. That's what the Mishnah says here, which is lo mikadshin, and with lo kedoshim, they don't receive kedusha even through tmura. They're not; it doesn't work. And with lo mikadshin, if they are kadosh, they cannot pass that tmura over to something else because they only have kedusha tamim. They do not have kedusha taguf. But again, here's another proof that this androgynous and tumtum are not classified as being a zachar. Next, we'll finish off the Mishnah in the Perek. B'leizomer chayven alav skilak zachar. Tanya. Amar Rabbi, kishalakti limul Torah itzel Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua. When I used to went to learn Torah by Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua, chavru alai tamidav, his students gathered up against me, kitana golim shal beit bukya, like the chickens of beit bukya, who were these very aggressive chickens who were very territorial, and they didn't let anybody come into their space. You came in there, they beat you up, these chickens. So the same thing over here, veloini nichuni lumot. They didn't let me stay and learn. They were very territorial. Rashi says they had to be great Talmid Chacham. They didn't want anybody else around them. They were Bikim and Harifim. And so they threw out any foreigner from there. Anybody who wasn't one of them, they threw him out, including Rabbi. They threw him out of there. He says, I only managed to get one thing in before they tossed me out or they gave me such a hard time. That's our Mishnah, which is Rabbi Lez Omer, Androgynous Chayin Olav, Skilas Kid Zachar. That last line of our Mishnah was the only thing that I got out of Rabbi Lezer ben Shemua before they gave me a hard time and pushed me out of there. And so that's again matches up with Rabbi Lezer's opinion that we saw in the Mishnah. Rabbi Lezer believes that Androgynous has the status of Zachar for Mishkav Zachar, like a Zachar, not as his Tzad Nekevot, but he does have a din of Zachar in this case. And with that, we end the Perek. Hadron Alach, Harel.